We are on the motion of the senator from Nottoway. Senator from the 13th, you have the floor.
Mr. President, I call the Senate back in. I had the floor. Oh, he just did that.
Senator from the 13th, that's what I just said.
I just want to inquire of you real quickly, Mr. President. I want you to realize the fact I've never had this opportunity to call us back in, so it was my first time, so I hope I didn't mess it up.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You have the floor.
Okay, thank you for the inquiry, Mr. President.
Senator from the 10th.
May I inquire of the senator from Andrew, please?
The senator from who?
Andrew.
Senator from Andrew. Is the senator from Andrew is in the chamber. Senator from Andrew, the senator from the 10th would like to inquire of you. Do you yield? He yields. Proceed, Senator.
Good evening, Senator.
Good evening.
Thanks for yielding to my inquiry.
No problem.
I think you and I were discussing this bill last week.
I believe so.
Last week. And I had raised a couple of questions with you that you were going to try to find some answers on, and I just wanted to follow up on those quickly.
Absolutely.
And see if you could shed a little light. One of the questions was, do you know whether it is your opinion that the that nonprofits are exempt from the language in this bill?
It is. That language that's in there is when I went and asked why it's, because there were two components, the nonprofit component and the labor union component. And it's my understanding is that is the way that it's structured under the federal law. So because of that, it's like all these groups are exempt except for the labor, because labor unions still employ people. So that came out of the federal structure, Senator.
Okay, so it's your understanding then that nonprofits are exempted from federal discrimination laws.
Is that?
That was my question. So
no, I don't believe nonprofits are exempted from it.
Okay, so is it just that membership clubs are exempted?
Yeah, membership clubs
are. If they are nonprofit, but not
except for
labor organizations.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
But it is in your opinion, or in the opinion of the drafters of this bill, this will not exempt all nonprofits.
That is correct.
Okay. Just wanted to check on that one.
Yep.
And then the next question that I had related to the summary judgment language. I'd asked where that came from. My question from that is, I know the answer. It doesn't mirror federal law. So what is it that you're trying to accomplish on that? Why is it different than federal law?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I follow your...
Okay. So the summary judgment standard...
I'm not sure how it's different than federal law, Senator.
Okay. So you're not sure how it's different or why it's different than federal law.
Right.
Were you aware that it is actually different than the summary judgment standard for civil cases in the state of Missouri?
I was not.
Okay. And is it your intention to set up a summary judgment standard that's different for employment cases than it is for civil cases under
My intent was for the whether the case was in federal court or that it was in state court, that the thresholds, the standards, however, whatever the right way is to say that they would be the same. So if it's not structured the same as it is in federal court, that is not my intent.
Okay.
So that may have been a misunderstanding on my part, a miscommunication. If there's adjustments that need to be made, I am open to being educated on what needs to happen there.
Well, the way that I understand, the way that the bill's drafted right now, that we have drafted a summary judgment standard into this bill that is actually different than the federal summary judgment standard, and it's different than the state summary judgment standard in other civil cases. So we're setting up a situation where plaintiffs in these employment discrimination cases would be governed by a different summary judgment standard than they would on the federal level, and a different summary judgment standard than they would in civil cases that are not employment cases. Okay. And that raises a couple of things for me. One, does it create an equal protection claim? Are plaintiffs who bring employment cases going to say, I'm being treated differently than plaintiffs in a civil case under tort or other theories? Sure. And then the second is, if our intent is really to mirror the federal law as far as the summary judgment is concerned, shouldn't we just put that federal summary judgment rule into this? And the reason I say it is this. A summary judgment standard is set up so that when there's no genuine issue of material right. fact, when the facts cannot be disputed, then the judge says, based on the law alone, right. you don't have a case, goodbye. And I have, as a young associate in a large law firm, drafted more motions for summary judgment than I ever want to remember. And what we do is we take a look at the facts as we know them, and we look at all of the depositions and all of the affidavits that we've taken from all of the parties, and we say, look, based on this court, they don't have a claim under the current law.
Right.
And my fear is the way that this has been drafted in this bill, that we are actually asking the court to be a trier of fact, to be a finder of fact. We're asking the court to make those factual determinations. And effectively what that will do is it will prevent plaintiffs from getting the jury trial that they're entitled to under the law, because we are actually having the judges become finders of fact instead of relying on the, you know, standard that is in existence on the federal level, which is there has to be no issue of genuine. And this is must sound like gibberish to you, Senator from Polk.
Say that last part again. On the federal level, there has to be.
There has to be. On the federal level, there cannot be an issue of fact that's still out there, a genuine issue of material fact that's still out there. And so my fear is that what we've done is we've effectively made it so that judges in state courts are now going to be finders of fact. And I don't think that's a place that you intended to be, or that really.
As we discussed that here, that was not my intent. Like, my intent is to not set up a more difficult structure in state court than federal court. So if we need to make some adjustments there, Senator, I'm not going to act like I am the expert on this.
And I don't want to either.
I am happy to figure out what we need to do there.
Okay. So that was really my main concern, were those main issues, is I wanted to get the answer on, frankly, the nonprofits issue, and I wanted to get a better sense of the summary judgment language. So one of the things that I think that I'm going to be working on as other senators continue their discussion tonight is drafting an amendment that I feel would make this summary judgment standard mirror the federal summary judgment standard, and I'll run that past you so that you can yep. run it past your folks. But that was what I wanted to follow up from our inquiry from last week, and I thank you for your inquiry.
Right, Senator, and I know it's your inquiry, but before we close here, my intent in this process is to make sure, is to bring Missouri back into line as the way it was prior to these decisions that moved it. So I have said the entire time, my intent is whether you're in state court or you're in federal court, you're treated the same. So whatever we need to do in this arena or others, I am very open to how we work through that.
Okay, so thank you, Senator.
You bet.
Mr. President.
Senator from the 10th.
May I inquire of the Senator from the 4th?
Does the Senator from the 4th yield?
I do.
Proceed, Senator.
Good evening, Senator.
Good evening.
You know, we're both lawyers.
We're both lawyers.
But neither one of us really practice in this area of law.
Employment law is not my strong point. You're correct.
And when I switched my career path from the path of representing food and drug and beverage manufacturers, where I frequently drafted motions for summary judgment, and moved to the representation of primarily kids in the foster care system, I really thought I had left summary judgment motions behind forever. And I know that your practice actually over the years has been in banking.
In banking, compliance, trust and estates, yep.
So probably you maybe have never even drafted a motion for summary judgment.
I have read a lot of them, but I've never drafted one.
And so to the extent that I'm going to have a prolonged discussion with you about summary judgment motions, I hate to tell the chamber, we're not going to do that tonight. but what I do want to do, if you don't mind, is just talk to you for just a couple of minutes on the bill, because I know that some of the senators who have some conversations that they'd like to have here on the floor, they're busy talking about some of these issues offline right now. And so I want to give them the opportunity to resolve some of those issues while you and I have a quick little discussion. You and I haven't had a chance to talk about this bill yet. I've heard some of the conversations that you've had with others. But what in particular were the two or three things that were really troublesome to you about this bill?
Well, obviously the most troubling thing is going from contributory to motivating.
Okay.
That is the single most troubling. Probably the second, and I don't know why we want to do that. I don't know why we want to make that step backward. It's so hard to get to a point in a trial where that even becomes a factor. Most of the cases don't even get that far. Why do we want to take that extra step and make it so much harder for a person to get relief? I don't see the problem that we're trying to solve with that.
Well, and unfortunately, I think that one of the kind of mischaracterizations about this bill is that somehow that this is a business climate bill that's going to make things better for businesses in Missouri and that will somehow help kind of move our economy forward. And Senator, I just can't imagine that this changing of this one little word is actually going to do anything to create jobs here in the state of Missouri.
Or to preserve them. I can't think of a single company that would move out of the state of Missouri. We talked earlier, the senator from the 11th, about the enterprise bill. You know, they did lose that case.
Yeah.
They're still here.
They're still in Missouri.
And that's the whole reason behind the bill.
Yeah. And, you know, Senator, I don't know if you remember this. Last year, this bill actually went through the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, no, wait a minute. Maybe it didn't. No, that's not true. That's not true. I don't think that's true.
Was it the year before?
I think maybe it was the year before. I think I misspoke. But I was on the committee that this bill went through last year.
Okay.
But it may have been Commerce. I'm not sure. But what I'm saying, what I'm trying to get to the point of saying is that when we heard the testimony on this bill last year, one of the gentlemen who was there trying to explain the bill to us said that companies were leaving Missouri or deciding not to come to Missouri because of our current employment law. And the thing that really frustrated me is I asked on several occasions, can you give me one example of a company that either decided to not come to Missouri or that left the state of Missouri because of our current employment discrimination laws? And they said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that information, attorney-client privilege, whatever the answer was. But the bottom line is absolutely no evidence came out whatsoever that any company had. As a matter of fact, from what I've heard, the business climate in Missouri is fantastic right now.
I think Forbes just came out and we're in the top 10.
Yeah, seriously. We've got some of the lowest taxes in the nation. We have some of the least regulations. I mean, for whoever's listening right now to our Senate feed tonight who's interested in doing business in Missouri, we are open for business.
That's right.
This is a good place to come do business. Come do business in Missouri, please.
That's right. The energy costs.
Thank you. Third lowest
in the country.
Exactly. Absolutely. We've got low energy costs. We've got low regulation. We've got low taxes. We've got a great place to live. I mean, let's just face it. This is a great place to live, to work, to play. I think everybody in this room, although we can't agree on just about anything else, I think would agree that Missouri is one of the best places in the country to live, work, and play.
The cost of living, it's a great place to raise a family.
Absolutely. You know, Cindy, it's funny that you would bring up the cost of living. You know, I work at a pretty large law firm. I don't know if you're familiar with that. We've got, I don't know, like 525 lawyers or so. And as such, we're always out looking for bright, young legal minds to attract to Kansas City. And sometimes we get into a tough jam where we're out on the East Coast interviewing at some of these hoity-toity schools, and we're saying, come to Kansas City, come live here and work here. And they're like, Kansas City? Why in the heck would I want to come to Kansas City? We were able to get a computer program that would show them what their salary in Kansas City would be if it were in New York City dollars, and they were blown away. They were absolutely blown away. We're like, here's where your salary will go in Kansas City. And I mean, one by one, they're like, well, that sounds fantastic. I'm going to come there. I'm going to get to own a home, and not just a home. I'm going to get to own a big home, if I want one, in a pretty cool place. I'm going to get to be able to have a decent quality of life where I don't have to work all night. You know, in New York City at the big law firms, they actually brag that they have cab service at home on the way home at night if you have to get out of there past like 2 a.m., and they'll feed you your meals while you're on the job. I'm sorry, that's not, to me, a benefit. I have no interest whatsoever in working at a place where they're going to be up all, you know, night doing that.
That's not a lifestyle.
That's not the lifestyle I want.
Right.
So.
Right. And, you know, back to that point about cost of living, you know, in St. Louis, we just lost Albert Pujols. He's going out to L.A., signed a humongous contract. But net, if you're taking the cost of living and taxes, he brings home less money in L.A. than he does here than he would have if he had taken the offer in St. Louis.
Should have stayed.
Should have stayed.
But, you know, we can't control for that, I suppose.
You know, as you and I both know, sometimes common sense just doesn't work.
No, it sure doesn't. There's no room for common sense. I remember one time, Senator, this is before you were here, I got up and I gave a pretty impassioned speech. I had a copy of the Missouri Constitution in my hands, and I was talking about how this is not constitutional and that's not constitutional and blah, blah, blah. And I set it down and I walked off the floor from that very desk where you're sitting right there. And two senators said to me, one says, Senator, I can't say my last name, but, you know, Senator whatever your name is, there's no room for common sense arguments in this chamber. There you go with your common sense arguments again. And then another one said, there's no place for the Constitution in this chamber. And they were being silly. I mean,
sure.
They weren't being mean.
Sure.
But the reality is that sometimes in these four walls, or however many walls there are in this building, common sense is just kind of thrown out the window.
Well, yeah, we let politics get in front of good public policy.
No, I totally understand. Hey, how you doing, Senator?
I'm good.
Feel like talking for another 10 minutes?
I sure do. You want to hear the second part I don't like?
Yes, please. Thank you.
I don't like page 7.
What's page 7 say?
Page 7, lines 70 to 73. We're excluding the state of Missouri and any of its political subdivisions from punitive damages. I don't know why we want to allow state employees the ability to discriminate without holding them accountable for punitive damages. The whole point of punitives is to be a deterrent. If state employees discriminate, they ought to be held to the same standard.
That makes sense to me. We employ a lot of folks, don't we?
We employ a lot of folks.
And political subdivisions employ a lot of folks, right?
Yep. And, you know,
political
over
subdivisions
the years,
include schools.
Schools.
Cities.
Cities. Towns.
Counties.
Townships.
Villages.
Villages.
What else do we have? Do we still have villages in the state of Missouri?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I think it's just that we can't create a village on our own. Is that, there was something a couple
there
years ago
about a village.
There was a village
bill that was before my time.
Okay. Because I own about an acre out in Callaway County, and I was thinking about, until they shut that down, I was going to create the village of Jolie.
What was the name of it?
I can say my first name, can't I?
Oh, the village of Jolie.
Yeah.
Jolie Land.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to call it. I was going to call it Jolie Land. But then I found out that I wouldn't be able to have any fire services, and I'd have to have my own fire department and my own public safety department, and I could have a casino, apparently, but I couldn't have those other amenities that we've come. So, no, I think that it doesn't make any sense at all to exempt such a massive number of people from those punitive damages. And I mean, the actions are no less egregious on that level than they are in the private sector. So,
in recent memory, you know, our track record hasn't been all that well in this area anyway.
Yeah, you're unfortunately correct. You're unfortunately correct. You know, while we're talking about stuff we don't like in this bill, you know, one of the things that I don't like is the individual liability issue.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that's kind of, and this is sort of one of those lawyerly sort of things that I hate to even bring up, but one of the things is that it actually punishes Missouri employers and favors out-of-state employers.
You'll have to walk me through that.
I'm going to walk you through it. It's real simple. Well, no, it's not real simple, but I'm going to walk you through it anyway because we have a few minutes while some other folks are getting some stuff together.
I've got lots of time to hear it.
So here's the bottom line. When you have a lawsuit in state court, a lot of times the defendants like to remove it to federal court because they have a perception that they get better treatment in federal court. And I think that's true based on the fact that employers in this state are coming in forward and saying that they'd like the state law to reflect the federal law. So if they want to be more like the feds, it's got to be for a reason. And so,
right.
So several times companies will try to remove their case from state court to federal court. And one of the ways that they can do that is to say that there's diversity jurisdiction. And there's diversity jurisdiction, obviously, when you've got someone from out of state and then someone from in state. So when you have individual liability, and I hope I'm going to get all this right because it's late in my mind and it's been a while since I took this class. But when you've got individual liability, then you could have someone who is a defendant who is also from Missouri, which means that you would keep that. You'd bust up the diversity and you'd keep it in state court. So what's going to happen is that Missouri defendants will not have that possibility to remove to federal court, but out-of-state defendants will have that possibility to remove
point.
To federal
yeah.
court.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that I'm not sure that it was the intent of the bill's drafter to give favorable treatment to out-of-state companies, but that is just that's something that's a byproduct of kind of what has happened. So. If this passes, that will be a byproduct of what happened. So, and then, I mean, and that's just from a sort of nerdy sort of, you know, removal perspective. There's also the perspective of if you've got an individual who does something wrong,
that's my
point. They should be held accountable.
I agree.
And earlier today, we were hearing some pretty egregious facts that had been laid out in some cases. And I'm not going to go through those facts, but
Thank
the reality
you.
Is that if those facts did exist, there is no reason that an individual should hide under the, you know, umbrella of their boss or their corporation and say and that we shouldn't hold them personally responsible for what they've done.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we talk about it all the time. It's real easy to spend someone else's nickel. And that's essentially what the employee would be doing. He's free to do whatever he wants because he's got no potential liability.
It's Absolutely.
Someone else's nickel.
Absolutely.
And at the end of the day, it'll be an insurance company.
Yep. So there's another reason that I'm not a fan of this bill. I think, you know, another reason is these caps that they've put in. Have you seen those caps?
I've seen the caps.
And we haven't really talked about it this year very much, but we talked about it quite a bit last year. And I don't remember the exact dollar amounts, but my concern was this. Say you have a person who has been diagnosed with cancer, and that cancer is going to take a significant amount of health care expenses to battle. So you've got an employer who is now under this new scheme, and they look at it and they say, you know what? I could continue to employ this person and pay what I know the health care costs will be over the next 5 to 10 years, or I could just flat out fire them because they have cancer.
Yep.
And the maximum that it's going to cost me is this figure that we put in this law.
Yep.
And to me, that's one of the most egregious parts about this bill, because that's like the old Ford Pinto case.
Yep.
Where you had Ford saying, you know what, it's going to cost me this much to fix all of these exploding cars, and it's only going to cost me this much to deal with all of these dead people, so I'm going to go ahead and let the people blow up. And that's exactly what could happen under this bill, is we could get into a situation where employers look at the just sheer dollars and decide, I will have to pay less in the long run if I fire this person with cancer than I would if she or he took me to court and I had to pay the maximum. And I think that's bad public policy.
Especially for the smaller companies. The way this is structured, you know, if a person has cancer, easily $10,000 a month.
Yep.
You got a cap of $50,000. That's not even 6 months.
And they're just let go.
Yep.
And the only recourse they have is to, number one, find a lawyer who will take the case, which, by the way, will be increasingly difficult with these caps in place. Because,
Right. Like
it or not, the cards are stacked against plaintiffs. Because plaintiffs don't have pockets that go on forever and ever,
well,
filled with cash.
And if you're sick enough, they can postpone it until you're not there.
Exactly. So there's that. And then once they find that lawyer, they have to hold on and fight this thing as they're also fighting cancer and trying to come up with the cash to pay for their health care expenses. And the end result is this maximum that the employer has to pay. And so it's not just this economic decision that the employer has to pay, it's the fallout that the plaintiff is dealing with as well. And that, to me, is one of the main reasons why these caps don't make sense. Because when you put a cap in a case like this, it makes it too easy for someone to just do the math, and the individual gets tossed out.
I agree. And, you know, no matter what size of company that you work for, your illness, the cost doesn't change.
No, it sure doesn't. And as we've talked about quite a bit in this chamber, you know, healthcare costs are not going to be going down anytime soon.
No.
And I wish that there was a way, and I know that there are a lot of good ideas that are floating out there. I know that are some that people might think are kind of crazy. I know that Mr. President up here on the dais right now, he's got some ideas relating to health care costs that I think he'd like to have the opportunity to talk about. I'm not asking him to talk about them now, but I know he's got some he'd like to talk about. We've got obviously some differing opinions among the chamber about how to contain health care costs, but the reality is that it's not happening right now.
Right.
These costs are only going up. And this is going to put people in danger of losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods, losing their lives.
And not to, with no consider, I mean, think of the damage it does to the family. You know, it's all dollars and cents here.
Yeah.
There's nothing about the family unit that you're trying to protect, the things that we all hold dear.
Exactly.
It's just a net bottom line.
You know, while we're talking about stuff that we don't like in the bill, I thought I'd bring up one more thing. If you have a minute.
Go ahead.
This whistleblower stuff. You know, we don't talk about it much because, frankly, it is sort of the lesser of the evils in this bill. But the reality is that this whistleblower stuff, you're not just putting at jeopardy the individual who is willing to take the risk and blow the whistle on a bad actor or someone they perceive to be a bad actor. you're putting everybody at risk, because a whistleblower is blowing a whistle because someone's doing something bad.
Yep. Yep.
And whether it's someone who's doing some crazy wheeling and dealing with books and wiping out people's pensions, or if it's someone standing behind a Quick Trip dumping cans of toxic stuff into Indian Creek.
Or the guy that knows that the Pinto is a bad car.
Exactly. We should be encouraging people to blow whistles. We shouldn't be making it harder for them to blow whistles.
I agree.
And so one of the things that frustrates me about this bill is that it's going to create a chilling effect on individuals who really want to be able to step up and say something bad, or I think something bad is going on in my company. And what I'm afraid that we're doing by passing this legislation, and I think one of the reasons why the governor vetoed it last year, is we want to create an environment where people who are willing to take the risk to stand up and blow a whistle and point out a potentially dangerous situation, that they're protected from retaliation. We want to encourage that behavior.
We want to encourage, yes, we want to encourage good behavior.
So we're not only putting in danger the individual who will get fired because of their noble act, but we're also putting in danger all of the citizens who are going to get bowled over by whatever bad act that person's employee was doing, or employer was doing.
I think that's correct. And let's go back to the Pinto in this case.
If
a guy, you know, if a guy knows that the Pinto is a bad car, with this bill, not only are we not protecting the guy or discouraging him from coming forward, and when the manufacturer knows it's a bad car, but we're putting a cap on the damages of the people that get hurt by the bad car. So we're kind of bringing both ends down.
Mm-hmm.
We're, again, a huge step backwards, back to the wild, wild west.
Shame. So, those are a few of the things. I don't know if you heard my discussion with the senator from Andrew. We also talked about some really annoying summary judgment stuff that, frankly, you know, neither here nor there. It bothers me because I think what we're asking judges to do is to become kind of the ultimate finders of fact and to rule on these cases, in these he said, she said cases, or he said, or whatever cases, before they get to a trial. And I think that that's not only a violation of their constitutional rights as plaintiffs, but I think that it also is also, once again, going to discourage individuals from stepping up and reporting, because they know that there's no hope that they're going to get any sort of compensation, but also any sort of corrective behavior. Is that behavior going to be corrected? So that's kind of where I am on it. We've kind of gone through the things. I know that there's some other senators who have been wanting to talk on this bill as well, and I want to give them the opportunity to do that.
I want to ask you one more question before
okay.
we stop. Did you ever get an answer on the private clubs?
I did. I got that just now, a couple minutes ago. And the private clubs have been exempted under state law, under this draft of the state law, because they're exempted under federal law.
Okay.
And it does not apply to all nonprofits, just to nonprofit membership clubs, but not labor unions. And that is a reflection of federal law.
Now, when we say nonprofit, are we talking 501s or... I mean, not all private clubs are nonprofits.
No, this has to be a private club that operates under the nonprofit 501c
okay.
laws.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. We are on the motion of the senator from Andrew. Does any other senator wish to be heard on this motion? Senator from the 9th.
Thank you. May I inquire of the senator from the 5th?
Does the senator from the 5th yield?
Yes.
She does. Proceed.
Good evening, or good morning.
Good evening. Good. Hello.
You got your coffee ready? Are you a coffee drinker?
Do I have what? You need to move your microphone better. I've got a middle ear thing going on anyway, so everybody's sounding a little muddy to me today.
Do you have your coffee ready?
Yes.
You're a coffee drinker?
No, my coffee is water or tea or juice.
Mine as well.
Can't my real coffee is nervous. A hot shower in the morning. That's my real coffee.
I hear you. I think we had left off earlier. I can't remember where we were.
You were reading a poem that I told you, Maya Angelou.
Oh, that's right. It was Still I Rise.
Yes, yeah, Still I Rise. Pretty routinely, she does a mm-hmm. very good dramatic reading of that.
She does. She's got some excellent poems. You know what? I have got a poem that, and I guess I don't necessarily have to go down the poem line right now, but I did have one that I used to love to read to my kids years ago. Of course, my kids are a lot older now. You know, I have two in school, one at Mizzou and one at Missouri State, but this clearly is a poem that I would love to read to them when they were younger kids. It's called The Crayon Box That Talked. Have you heard of that one before?
No, I haven't. Is that a Langston Hughes poem?
No, it isn't.
Who is it?
Shane DeRolf. I'm not sure who he is, but I clearly have always liked the poem. The Crayon Box That Talked. While walking into a toy store the day before today, I overheard a crayon box with many things to say. I don't like red, said yellow, and green said, nor do I. And no one here likes orange, but no one knows just why. We are a box of crayons that doesn't get along, said blue to all the others, something here is wrong. Well, I bought that box of crayons and took it home with me and laid out all the colors so the crayons all could see. They watched me as I colored with red and blue and green and black and white and orange and every color in between. They watched as green became the grass and blue became the sky. The yellow sun was shining bright on white clouds drifting by. Colors changing as they touched, becoming something new. They watched me as I colored. They watched me till I was through. And when I finally finished, I began to walk away. And as I did, the crayon box had something more to say. I do like red, said yellow, and green said, so do I. And blue, you were terrific, so high up in the sky. We are a box of crayons, each one of us unique. But when we get together, the picture is more complete.
You said you read that to your own children. Is that right? To
I
your
did.
Own. But you also read in the schools.
Do I read in schools?
Do you read in some of the schools? Do you
I do.
Do that program? Yeah.
I do.
That's a very good poem for kids, especially in the primary grades. Really all the grades, but it's good in primary. It really kind of trains
them. Well, it
is,
and I think it teaches kids a little bit something about diversity. And it teaches them things about different colors and people who may look slightly different than they do.
But we're all crayon, all right.
It is. It was. So that happened to be one, as I said, that I liked reading to my kids when they were very young.
What about some Paul Laurence Dunbar? Do you have any of him in your folder?
I don't have any of his here. Certainly if someone is listening and they'd like to bring some Paul Laurence Dunbar down.
Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Oh, here's one. It's called The Bridge Builder. And this is a poem that my grandfather had given to me years ago. He hoped that he could be a bridge builder between himself and the younger generation. Of course, my grandfather is 93 now. And that he hoped that, in fact, I would become a bridge builder as I became older so that we learned to mentor those clearly who have come after us.
All right.
Would you like to hear that one as well?
Yes.
It's by Will Allen Drum Google. An old man going alone highway came at the evening cold and gray to a chasm vast and deep and wide through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fear for him. But he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. Old man, said a fellow pilgrim near, you are wasting your strength with building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again will pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide why build this bridge at evening time? The builder lifted his old gray head. Good friend, in the path I have come, he said. There followed after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been is not to me, to that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I am building this bridge for him.
How old is that? Do you know? Does it have a date on it?
Oh, you know, I don't know, but he had given me this years ago when I was in high school. And my grandfather has always been actually a bridge builder. You know, he's one of the only remaining founding member of an organization we have there, a political organization in Kansas City.
Okay.
And
as a founding member?
He is. He's the only surviving founding member. He is. So he's done a lot of things. He's seen a lot of things. As I said, he's 93. He's still active. He still goes to the family office every day and answers the phone, except on, I think it's Wednesday, when he goes to
the golf course.
He still hooks up with his high school friends. There are a few of his friends that still meet in his graduating class, and they, you know, go to breakfast and play dominoes and all those other things on Wednesdays. So Wednesdays is the only day he does not come into the office still at 93.
That's good. He stayed very active then.
He does.
Very active. Now, you said he hoped that you would be a bridge builder. You've become a senator. You've been a state rep. Don't you consider yourself a bridge builder? Somewhere back there, you've built some bridges. Somewhere up here, you may have built some bridges.
You know what? Absolutely. I think, as I've said when I had first come over to this body, what I do hope is that I would be able to provide some opportunities for youth, where it happens to be, whether it happens to be for folks that are just graduating from college, whether it happens to be from internships in my office. The legislative director that I, of course, just had graduated from law school and passed the bar this summer. So I want to make sure that I give opportunities to young people to be able to experience what we have here in the legislature,
yes,
that sometimes are taken advantage of by other folks. But, you know, when you come from areas that don't have the resources for them maybe to be able to travel back and forth, it makes it a little more difficult. So, so absolutely, that's something I live by.
Well, inside the foundation, Senator, I know that there is a track for the young people every year when we have our not our caucus, but our conference.
Right.
Young people's track. Has that always been there through all of the conferences we've had?
Pretty much. The youth conference, the youth leadership conference. Oh, absolutely.
And have we had kids who've come out of that conference who maybe at this point in time may have come through the legislature?
We have, in fact. Representative Connie Johnson clearly had been one that had come through the youth conference there and then ended up later getting a job with Senator. She may have been Representative Paula Carter then. I'm not sure when Connie started working for her. But also Amber Boykins, who happened to be a state rep as well.
Okay. So we've had people to come through those conferences. What's the focus of the conference? We do talk legislatively. I know we talk about economic development, education, jobs.
Right.
And we also talk about the legislative body and what purpose they could serve here and what they could bring to this particular career.
Right, absolutely. It's a youth leadership conference, and it also teaches them about public servitude. It does. We have a series of workshops. Some of those things that you addressed earlier, economic development and education, and all those things are addressed. But it also gives them some leadership training. It provides an opportunity for them for mentorship between some of the legislators and other folks we have in the professional community that are willing to come over and mentor some of the students as well. It's an excellent program.
I agree. And every year we serve more and more youth. We've had a high of, what, 250 kids at one time?
I think it was 350 or 400 at one time, actually.
Okay, indeed. So we've touched a lot of kids from all across the state. We get them.
Yeah, we have.
Absolutely. In your packet of poetry, Senator, I know you said you had some favorites in there. You spoke of one on the floor the other day that you remembered as a child, you said. Whose poem was that?
County Cullen's. The
County
Incident.
Cullen, absolutely. All out of the Harlem Renaissance.
Right.
All of these writers pretty much came out of the Harlem Renaissance.
It was.
Go ahead.
You know, I think I said the other day, that poem was a poem that I had read as a child and for some reason remembered it and hadn't heard it in years. And it was just kind of one of those that had gripped me emotionally where I remembered it. And it is kind of, it was strange even for me that I would have remembered it for so many years, not even having thought of it or recited it in so many years. So.
Inside your packet, what else do you have?
Oh, let's see what I have. The Road Not Taken, Robert Frost.
You got Robert Frost?
I do have Robert Frost here.
I heard somebody say they like
it. You can be whatever you want to be, by Donna Levine. The Victor, by C.W. Longenecker. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you like to win but think you can't, it's almost a cinch you won't. If you think you'll lose, you're lost. For out in the world we find, success begins with the fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind. If you think you are outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you can ever win the prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the man who wins is the man who thinks he can.
Interesting.
Which is one I would read to my kids additionally.
I heard somebody say the Robert Frost poem. Go back to that one.
The Road Not Taken?
Yes.
The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged on a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
You know, in reading things, Senator, former Governor Bob Holden and I had an opportunity to sit and talk, and have done this several times, actually, since he's been out of office. He recommended a couple of books to me. One of them is Caught in the Middle, has to do with America's heartland in the age of globalism, because, of course, we were the breadbasket of the world, and so many things have changed here in the Midwest. Obviously, we're in a highly technical age, and it's been hard on our family farms. It's been hard on the towns that grew up in the Midwest that were connected by county roads and country roads, and the technology has moved to the larger urban areas, and we have suffered in the Midwest, and a lot of the very things that we fight here in the state of Missouri, because we are a very agrarian state, it's really agriculture and tourism that keep us afloat. And I remember Wes Schumacher telling me at one time, former Senator Schumacher said to me, "You're involved in agriculture if you eat." So that has a profound impact on all of us, whether we live in the city or not. If we're eating, we're involved in agriculture, and it's important to know what goes on there and how it impacts us. When I first came in the House, I was on the Agriculture Committee, and I'm a city girl, born and raised, and it was very interesting to me to listen to the concerns of our farmers firsthand, to listen to the people who came in to testify about their family farms and the things they were trying to do to hold on. And I know that we have members here in this body who live in the rural areas, who have family farms and other concerns out there, and it's important that we have a soft ear for those issues, because we all have to live here together, and it makes all of this makes the state of Missouri. But in the first few pages of The prologue actually is quite interesting, caught in the middle. I'd kind of like to read the first few paragraphs here because it frames where he's going to go. It says, I grew up in a small town in central Iowa, a safe and secure place, confident in its isolation. This was Lonesome Whistle territory, where passing trains announced another world out there. In time, some of us got on those trains and went to seek the world. We knew it wasn't going to come to us. Not too much happened in my town, a county seat called Boone, but there was a bustle, and this is not Boone here in Missouri either, by the way, this is an Iowa town, but there was a bustle in the mid-1960s when a British newspaper proclaimed that the typical American small town geographically and socially and sent a reporter to write about it. He interviewed one local elder who pronounced, we are pretty well self-sufficient, we don't need the world. Interesting. We don't need the world, but the world is us, is it not?
It is us.
We have to lift up our children who are in higher education so they can compete in a global marketplace these days.
Right.
We have to make sure that they have the right tools and skills when they come out of school to compete in the global marketplace so they can compete against the graduates around the world, not just those here in the United States of America. Missouri is situated in the middle of the country. The population center is yet in the state of Missouri, kind of in the south central area. And we really are the bellwether and still have become that. It was interesting as I went on through this book that he really brought up some very poignant remembrances and how those have impacted how he sees the world today. This was written, by the way, by Richard Longworth several years ago, 2008. And I have recommended it to many people, and certainly I'm sure members of this body, because we have a lot of our senators who come in with books in their hands. They do a lot of reading. It would be really good for everybody to kind of read it and have in their mind where Missouri stands in the global marketplace now that things have changed so dramatically. And of course, we fight these issues every day in this body,
right,
and across the rotunda in the House. And we just have to open our minds up and find out how we're going to be able to fit in the future.
Mm-hmm. We do, which even presents more of a challenge. I mean, I think you were talking about higher ed, but even as far as elementary and secondary, I mean, clearly I think us, we here in the body at least know of the unfortunate circumstance we have in Kansas City School District.
Yes.
And, you know, it is difficult. It is difficult when you have kids in an urban city who are affected by so many socioeconomic factors, and all of those things play into education. I certainly hope there's a solution that we find in educating our kids. You know, education is fundamental. If we're wanting our kids to be able to have some success, whether we want them to go to college and we want them to be productive citizens after that, and that is something that is just so basic.
Knowledge is power.
It is.
Knowledge is power. It is basic. It is fundamental. I get concerned that every kid is not getting the same exposure to skills. Mm-hmm. When I was teaching in the 70s, they changed how reading, language, spelling, and pretty much reading, language, and spelling were no, and penmanship, which is really getting ready to go straight out the window. They're not even teaching cursive writing in many places already. They changed how they did that, and those of us who were in grade school, all of those were separate. There was reading, mm-hmm. there was spelling, there was writing,
right,
there was language. You had tests. You got a proficient level of it, and you knew that you could do whatever was necessary with the King's English. Well, they kind of combined all that into what they call communication arts, and I don't think that's a very effective tool mm-hmm. for teaching the kid the skills they need to understand the language, to use the language, and to be able to walk and talk in an intelligent fashion. So our education is truly under siege still, and it concerns me that some school systems are doing the communication arts, but yet there are systems, some public, some private, that are doing the individual spelling and reading and mm-hmm. language. It strengthens the skills that our children need in the marketplace. They're teaching English in other parts of the world, and we need to have a command of it as well if we're going to be sufficient and able to, you know, produce a decent quality of life for our families.
Right.
Right, I agree, Senator. I do critically. I think all of us here understand the importance of a great education. I think it's something that we all struggle with. Mm-hmm. Certainly, those of us from urban communities, in making sure kids have what they need to be able to succeed from grade school into high school into college, and it becomes a huge challenge right now, especially as we decide where we need to go and what we need to do to make sure kids are getting what they need as far as their education.
I know you mentioned to me in another casual conversation that you had 30% of your public school children were in charter schools. Is that
they
right?
Are. In the Kansas City School District, around 30% of the kids in the Kansas City School District are in charter schools currently. It is. And it is, we have this charter school bill that comes up every year, and I think it is interesting because in the past I had not been necessarily for expansion of charter schools. But clearly what is most important to me at this point is accountability. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know at this point that I care about expansion in other areas of the state because accountability is most important. When you have 50 to 60% of the charter schools that are not even performing as well mm-hmm. as the failing school districts, that's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. That's unacceptable. And 30% of the kids in the Kansas City School District, which mostly happens to be my district, are those mm-hmm. kids.
Now, are your charter schools public charter schools or are these private for-profit institutions?
I think all the charter schools are considered public.
Considered public.
Quote, right.
But does your school system sponsor any of them?
Our school district has one contract school. So they don't sponsor, our school district does not sponsor any of the charters, but they do have, there's one contract school in the Kansas City School District.
We have, in my district, we have the Career Construction Academy, which is wonderful, I think, because it gives to a child a skill. Mm-hmm. When they come out of high school, they have actually had an opportunity to be involved with the trades, whether mm-hmm. that's electrician or carpentry or, the building trades. And it really gives them a skill where they can really pick up some type of apprenticeship right off the bat. And because every kid is not going to go to college, but everybody should have a skill that they can create a decent life with. It's important that we keep these things alive. I like the idea and the diversity of that educational moment when we have the trades that are willing to come into our schools and do the work that they do. It's also important that we reach each kid at their modality. They need to either be able to hear it or touch it. They have to be able to express it, and they have to be able to test it out so that they can continue to be strong out here in the marketplace. So in my district, Senator, I'm sorry. In my district, Senator, we have 3,000 children that are homeless, absolutely homeless. They have no shelter. They have no home. They're living God only knows where from place to place, potentially in a car. But school is the greatest thing that happens to them that day because they have shelter. They have clothing. Because the schools have washing machines to wash the kids' clothes. They have instances where they can get coats in the wintertime. They have a nurse, hopefully, if the system has been able to sustain that. They have a social worker if they have needs that cannot be met at school alone, medical needs as well. So we have to deal with the realities of urban education. Homelessness is a growing concern. And with our 3,000 kids in the St. Louis public system, they have to be addressed. They come there for shelter. They come for food. They come for comfort. Having taught school in a part of North St. Louis that is very low to moderate income, you cannot teach a child that is, that his mind, she has the floor.
See if she'll understand it easy.
Did you tell her that?
If you ask him to stand it.
Senator from the 11th, or from the 13th,
may we stand at ease?
The senator from the...
I seek unanimous consent, Mr. President.
Senator from the 9th has requested unanimous consent to stand at ease. Does any senator object? Seeing none, the Senate will stand at ease.
Miami. I thought you might be facilitating things, you know. I was giving you the benefit of the doubt. I kind of figured Ingram was too.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. Mr. President, can you call us back into order, please?
Senate is now back in session. Senator from the Ninth.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm done with my inquiry. Thank you.
Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. I believe I have an amendment pending. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I'd ask that amendment be sent back.
It will be sent back, Senator.
Mr. President, I believe we have a Senate committee sub. The motion pending is an adoption for a Senate committee sub. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a Senate sub.
Please send that forward. Has it been distributed?
I believe it is being distributed, Mr. President. I will request a waiver of the reading, understanding I will not close until after it has been
hearing no objection, the reading will be waived. There will be no vote taken until after distribution. Senator from Andrew, would you like to explain your...
Thank you. I will, Mr. President. Essentially, this is the underlying bill with a couple of the amendments that had been distributed already added to it. It is my understanding the senator from the 14th will be offering amendment shortly when she gets to the floor. I believe that amendment will be fine. We will end up adopting it. With that, Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Senate substitute.
Thank you, Senators. Senator from the Andrews moves the adoption of Senate substitute. For Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 592, does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the Third, what purpose do you seek recognition?
To inquire the senator from Andrew.
Senator from Andrew, you yield. He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Thank you. I know we've got a few minutes before this is all wrapped up, but it's been a long day and a long last week, and I know we're going to visit the subject again. But I appreciate people's temperaments the last hour or so and trying to get things worked out. I wanted to particularly thank the senator from the 5th and the senator I'm trying to find, senator from the 9th, who have helped in this. And I know this subject is near and dear to them, and they've done a great job of work today trying to defend their position, and they're willing to work with everybody, including the senator from the 9th in this decision. But I wanted to thank them, too.
And I think, Senator, another...
And only one of them, all three, have worked on day, and she's worked very hard on this, but these two were willing to stand here and stay all night, and we thank them for their willingness to try to forge some compromise and let us...
Right. The senator from the 9th, the senator from the 5th have been great as we work through this. The senator from the 14th and the senator from the 10th, I believe, have identified a section here that as we talked offline about the bill, I think they have raised some very valid points. I believe the senator from the 14th is going to have an amendment to fix that for us.
And I just wanted to say I appreciated you working with them, and I appreciated those three senators in particular indulgence in working with us to try to find a solution.
Thank you, Senator.
They all deserve credit. Thank you.
We're on the motion of the Senator from Andrew. Senator from the 14th, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you, Mr. President. I have an amendment.
Please send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
No, it has not. And it could be read.
Madam Secretary, please read the amendment.
Senate Amendment 1, offered by Senator Chappelle Nadal to amend Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 592, pages 6 through 8, section 203.101, by striking all of said section from the bill, and further amend the title and enacting clause accordingly.
Senator, would you like to move to the adoption of your amendment?
Yes, I do move for its adoption.
And would you like to explain the amendment?
I would. You know, we have been here all day long talking about an issue that is very near and dear to each and every single one of us for one reason or the other. And I stood before you, Mr. President, for 10 hours today because my heart is in this issue. There are some fundamental beliefs that I have that an individual who has been discriminated against should be judged or have a group of people who determine the outcome of a situation in which the plaintiff, the individual, the victim feels as though they have been wronged. And the way that the bill was originally designed, we did not, the victim did not, have an opportunity to seek resolution with a jury. The language that I'm specifically talking about has to do with summary judgment. And I believe that defendants need to have a set of people that are listening and watching everything that is said in a court case, in a trial. There are many examples that I have given today, many cases that I have read from, some cases that have gone through summary judgment and have been thrown out by an individual judge. And I think that's wrong. I think oftentimes we have these law clerks who are reading through some of the facts of a case, and I truly believe the facts of a case, no matter how deep or how troubling the facts may be of a case, these facts should be absolutely part of a trial where there are 12 people who make a determination on what damages should be and also determine the credibility of the case and the people who are part of any case. And so I have this amendment, Mr. President, because it is a fundamental belief that I have, that many people have, that victims should have a trial with a jury. And I am just trying to remove the language from the substitute and to ensure that victims are able to go to a jury and not have one individual make a decision on whether or not the facts of a case are good enough or not. And so with that, Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the bill. If there are any questions.
Senator from the 14th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1 to Senate Substitute. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Andrew, what purpose do you seek recognition?
To speak on the amendment.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. As the senator from the 14th said, I think she's identified an area here where clearly there was confusion through the help of the senator from the 10th. I think we are moving in the right direction here. I'm very comfortable with the amendment that the senator from the 14th is offering, and I would encourage the members of the body to support her amendment.
On the motion, Senator from the 14th, does any other senator wish to speak on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I close.
Senator from the 14th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The amendment is adopted. We're back on the motion from the senator from Andrew. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I renew my motion for the adoption of the Senate substitute.
Senator from Andrews moved adoption for the Senate substitute for Senate Bill 592. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Yeah. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The motion is carried. Senator, you're recognized for the perfection motion.
President, I move that Senate Bill 592 be perfected.
You've heard an order printed. The Senator from Andrew has moved for the perfection motion on Senate Bill 592 is adopted as amended by Senate substitute. All in favor of that motion. Any senator have a question about that motion? Or Warren? Does anybody want to say anything on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. President. Before I close, we are here nearly 15 hours after we began this process. And although it has not been maybe as smooth or as enjoyable as any of us had hoped, the reality is what is happening right now is the public policy process. This is how the Senate works. This is the difference between the Senate and the House. And this is why, ultimately, I still believe that in our state and in the process that we all navigate through every year, day in and day out, we do end up with better public policy because we are willing to endure these difficult moments and ultimately come up with legislation that everyone can at least let move forward. With that, Mr. President, I renew my motion. I close.
The senator from Andrew has moved that the Senate Bill 592 as amended by the Senate substitute be declared perfected and ordered printed. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. That motion is carried. Senator from the 23rd.
Mr. President, without objection, Senator, go to the order of business of announcements.
We're on the order of business of announcements. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming before the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from the 23rd. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate will stand adjourned under the rules.